won't want to miss. It's a double whammy. We're celebrating Shivaratri, which honours Shiva in his many forms, and it also has a lot of special yogic power on that night. I know that if you say mantras, they're worth 10,000 times more just for one. So, you know, that's worth coming for just in and of itself. But also, it's the book launch of Guruji's much-awaited spiritual autobiography. Woo! Next week. It really is next week. So don't miss your chance to pre-purchase the book tonight, and so that you can receive it in darshan from Guruji next week, and that'll be a special event. So come along, we'll see you there. Then the next day, that's on Sunday, the Sunday, the 23rd of Feb, at 2:30 p.m., we have Goti's memorial. And as many of you know, Goti is a beloved member of our satsang, and he was a Baba devotee and also a resident of the ashram for many years. So you're all welcome to come on the Sunday to remember him. And then finally, Devi Ma's Learn to Meditate course starts this Thursday, and it runs for 4 consecutive Thursday evenings. And if you haven't done the Learn to Meditate course, it's a really wonderful introduction to the meditation techniques of our tradition. And it's based on Swamiji's best-selling book, Happy for No Good Reason. And also consider inviting your family and friends along that haven't done the course before, because it really does contain essential inner life skills that we'd like to share with our nearest and dearest. And the added bonus, of course, is that it's taught by Devi Ma, who's a wonderful teacher of meditation. So for more information on our online courses or to register for any of the programs, you can visit our website, theashram.com.au.
Welcome, everybody. Welcome to tonight's satsang. I always like to begin my program by remembering my guru, Swami Muktananda, who began every program by saying in Hindi, Sabko bada sanmane ke saath prem se hridik swagat. With great respect and love, I welcome you all with all my heart. And he always emphasized that welcome. He said we should live that welcome. So I say that every week, and I always quote Baba, and I say that. But I thought today I would delve into my files and find an actual welcome they give to show you how he did it. He would do it differently every night. So this is from a program at the Oakland Ashram in January of 1979, the beginning of an evening session with Baba. He says, Satgurunat Maharaj Ki Jai, with great respect and love, I welcome you all with all my heart. Or, Sabko Bade Sanmane Ke Saath, Sabko Bade Sanmane Ke Saath, Prem Se Hridik Swagat. Something like that. He says, this is a great worship. Japa, mantra repetition, meditation, and also a great attainment. Man should learn how to look at others with respect. You should also learn how to look at others with love so that you can celebrate happiness within yourself. There's a great scripture, a great sadhana of Shaivism, which is called the Vijnana Bhārava. It is a tantric scripture. The Vijnana Bhārava is an ancient text which has 112 different meditations. Very brilliant, useful text. We've studied a lot here. Baba says, the Vijnana Bhārava teaches that this is the attainment. Whoever you see, you should celebrate happiness within yourself when you see another person. The Shiva Sutras, a text of Kashmir Shaivism, say that when you look at others with the awareness that others are the image of God, then happiness arises within you, and that happiness, that bliss, is greater than the bliss of samadhi. Baba's referring to the Sutra Lokananda Samadhi Sukham, saying that if you relate to people with love, the bliss you get is like the bliss that yogis feel in meditation. It's the bliss of samadhi. Baba says, the Indian psychology says you create your own happiness with your own attitude, with your own understanding. That was the first very profound thing that I learned from Baba. He says that happiness is not a result of circumstances, and misery is not a result of circumstances, but of our own attitude. And that there, because of that, we have the control over that. We can work with our own attitude, Chan Shlomit. He says, you create your own depression, your own agony, your own pain with your own action and with your own attitude. So Shaivism says that a person's inner feeling, a person's mind, is the source of his or her own pain or pleasure. There's nobody else who's the cause of his pain or pleasure. For example, you look at a person. When you look at a person, you feel disturbed inside you. You feel a kind of pain inside you. And you get kind of angry, too. However, that person's not affected at all. You look at another person, and inside yourself, you experience happiness. So your happiness or unhappiness depends on your own outlook. With his mind, man creates his own happiness, his own unhappiness, his bondage, his liberation, good things and bad things, and he enjoys or suffers the consequences of these things. For this reason, we should welcome another person with love. So that was on 1979 when Baba was welcomed. And I also should welcome everyone who's watching around the world on the global satsang. Let's see, in New York, in Ann Arbor, in McHenry, Illinois, in Detroit, in Canada, in Germany, in Hungary, and in Ganeshpuri, Govindananda, Uma, Les, Sarah, and Lakshmi, all watching in Ganeshpuri, in Japan, and in Taiwan. Special hello at the Adelaide Center. It's Dai Devi's birthday. Dai Devi, Maruti, Radhika, Pina, Janavi, all watching in Adelaide. At the Brisbane Center, at Sharada's house, Sharada, Karuna, Nazari. In Noosa, in the Sunshine Coast, Byron Bay, Blue Mountains, in Sydney, in Melbourne, in Ringwood, in Elwood, and someone in their Murrumbeena home is watching, and in the ashram. I've got my usual frog in my throat, so you'll have to pardon me. So, you know, the subject of my program's always is the great beings. And I never knew that great beings existed in the sense of great yogis, great saints, great realizers, great self-realized beings until I began the path of yoga after I met the American teacher Ramdas, who passed away very recently. And the night I met him, I became aware that there were great beings alive now, not just thousands of years ago. And so I always celebrate these great beings. I think of them as humanity's greatest unsung resource. There are many kinds of resources that we have, but the great beings are a resource of a different kind because they can take us to a place within ourselves that we only can imagine, and a possibility within ourselves that we can only imagine. And yet it's very real and very possible for all of us. And they teach a method and a path, an inner path, a way of getting control over your mind and emotions and going deeper than that and getting in touch with your authentic and true self. And in that authentic and true self, there's peace and there's love and there's wisdom, there's everything that we seek. But when the surface mind is agitated and filled with anger and sadness and depression, we can't get in touch with that place. But the great beings are those who have conquered that and who dwell permanently in that place of higher consciousness and joy. And so they're a great resource. They're great beings in all traditions. And tonight's is very unusual. The ones that I cite are from the Indian tradition, the Indian yogis. But of course, they're great beings in every tradition. I like to come back to this one every once in a while because he taught an exquisite inner method. And he's from the Jewish tradition, and he is, recent photograph, Rabbi Nachman of Breslau. Nachman of Breslau, he's my subject. He lived from 1772 to 1810, short life of 38 years. He was born in eastern Poland, which is now part of the Ukraine. I shouldn't say the Ukraine, I should say part of Ukraine. And he was a Hasidic rabbi, and he was a guru to his followers. Let me say something about Hasidism. Okay. He's so handsome, you're all looking at him, so turn. the Hasid is a sect, let's say, of Judaism, very visible in the modern world because they dress in a distinctive, almost medieval style, and they seem like an insular cult, and they're often referred to as the ultra-Orthodox. But in a sense, I don't think that's an accurate designation, because at the beginning of the Hasidic movement back in the 18th century, they were radicals and ecstatics and mystics. They were rebelling against what was then a dry intellectualism of 18th century Judaism, very cerebral and by the book. and they were introduced to a practice of joy by a very charismatic figure who began him. His name is the Baal Shem Tov. They also call him the Besht. And Tov means master of the good name. Now, that could have to do with the mantra, I think. I once had I grew up in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, which is the center of Hasidism. Well, let me get to that. Anyway, he lived from 1700 to 1760. He was truly a God-intoxicated being. Now, the Orthodox actually hated the Hasidim because they used to chant and dance and celebrate. The Orthodox were led by a famous 18th century rabbi who's called the Gaon of Vilna. And he excommunicated them. And so I read all this Hasidic literature at some point in my life. Martin Buber wrote about it and lots of material on it. And so the Gaon of Vilna was always, as the name sounds, he's a villain. The villain of Gaon. And he's a villain. And then once I was when I was in Elwood, here, when we were running the ashram in Elwood many years ago, I had a GP in Elwood, and I was talking about these matters, and it turned out he was a follower of the Gaon of Vilna. It blew my mind. It's like, you know, and so he had a completely different picture. You know, they say that history is written by the winners. And yet there's a whole different story from another point of view. And he was telling me that the Orthodox then feared what they called spiritual afflatus. You know what spiritual afflatus is? Afflatus is inflation, where you get so intoxicated you lose your brains. And this can happen spiritually. A person can become very intoxicated. Because in the 17th century, there was a Jewish messiah. Do you know this story? Named Sabbatai Zvi. You know about him? He was inflated. He might have been bipolar. That was the thing about him. And he got very, very high. And they all the Jews in Europe thought he was the messiah. And the Christians started to believe he was the second coming. And wherever he went, he was filled with energy and shakti and so on. And the whole of Europe was in an uproar. And he went to Turkey, and he was going to convert what's the head guy?
The imam.
The imam, no, he's the...
The
The Sultan, the Caliph. Sultan. The, no, not the Sultan, Caliph?
The Caliph.
Sultan. Whatever, that dude there. And it ended up, he converted to Islam is what happened. And he came crashing down. It's an amazing story and had a tragic ending. I think he died in jail in Turkey. But even to this day, there are followers of him. There are followers of him. You know, the tennis player Sabatini, that could very well, that could go back to that, Sabatini. I'm not sure about that, so don't quote me. But that was such a disaster that they feared, the Gaon of Vilna feared that, and they didn't want religion to get too ecstatic. And so they were. There's always a tension between the rational side of spirituality or religion and the ecstatic side. And they don't like each other much. This one's trying to get free of that one, and that one's trying to control that one. And back and forth. So it's also known as the war between the solids and the peculiars. It happens even in marriages. So I can say no more at this point. But Hasidism is actually a guru-disciple tradition. The Baal Shem Tov had a great disciple who was named the Magid of Meserich. And he was very different. While the Baal Shem Tov was very peculiar and mystical, the Magid was solid and rational and scholar. And he had 12, he had himself 12 disciples, and they became 12 traditions, gurukulas, you know, schools. And we would call them satsangs, maybe. And they've come down through succession to the present day. And after World War II, many of the Hasidim came to, they came here and they came to America. And they settled in my neighborhood in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. And I got to know them a little bit. I used to play stickball with them till they were 13. Then they didn't know me anymore. But I never knew that I was living with a guru-disciple,
school.
Community or school, you know, until I myself became a disciple. And I took a fresh look at it. It blew my mind that there was a guru living in my neighborhood, you know, and his disciples.
Yeshiva.
Huh? Yeshiva, yeah. And it's true that the original ecstatic impulse of the Baal Shem Tov may have diminished over the years, but you should take a look at a Hasidic wedding on YouTube, man.
Yeah.
There's plenty of ecstasy still there. Anyway, Rabbi Nachman was the great-grandson of the Baal Shem Tov. His grandmother was the daughter, the only daughter of the Baal Shem Tov. And he had a short life full of controversies and sufferings, and I won't go into it all. But he, in 1802, he moved to Breslau, and he attracted his major disciple, whose name was Rabbi Nathan. And Rabbi Nathan promoted his teachings, and then he died of TB at the age of 38. This is Nachman. But Nathan worked, published his teachings, promoted, and eventually there were thousands of followers, and his lineage comes down today. And in the Hasidic tradition, there's succession. So a rabbi designates, or somehow they designate a successor. But in their tradition, there is no successor. In Nachman. Nachman is still the guru of that lineage. But none of this is important. What's important is...
But you love it.
What?
But you love it.
I like it, yeah. Yeah. I didn't grow up among these guys. I grew up in a group called the Satmar Hasidim. You know of the Lubavitchers, probably. The Satmar were in my neighborhood. So anyway, His main teaching was called Hit Bodhidut, and it's a method of prayer, and it's very related to Shiva process in some ways. And what it is, he taught to have a frank, open, and honest conversation with God in your inner world. And this works even if you don't believe in God, if you just think of consciousness, or even think of your higher self. And you it's kind of, Buber would call it the I-thou relationship. You don't talk about God as he, but you speak to God as I-thou. And in that conversation, you discover things about yourself. You discover what's authentic and what's not authentic, and what's uplifting and what's not uplifting. And by doing that, you would process all your hidden desires and fears, unconscious urges and so on, and eventually come to peace. And Nachman used the term nullification, which means to go beyond ego. Because it's our ego, our selfishness, that limits us spiritually. And he said, include your soul in the source, which is God, the necessary existence. Include the whole world in the source along with your soul. Then you achieve nullification of the ego. So undo the separation, become one. This is like the yogic term samavesha, where a yogi tries to merge in consciousness, or in Shiva samavesha, to become one with it. And so he taught something like that. And it's something like Shiva process, because you have to examine yourself and you discover it through dialogue. So these are some translations from his works. You ready? We'll try it out too. And I really recommend this. I'll tell you first, I'll say the basic idea is to have a completely frank and honest conversation, including everything about yourself. You know, when we present ourselves to others, we often have a mask. We try to look good, and we try to impress, or whatever we do our number. But in your inner space, be naked like a child, and admit to all your urges and whatever they are, and things that you might be ashamed of, and you let that all hang out. And there's tremendous value in that. So here's what he says. With me so far? Okay, he says, Hit Bodhidut meditation is the best and the highest level of worship. Set aside an hour or more each day to meditate in the fields or in a room, pouring out your thoughts to God. Make use of arguments and persuasion with words of grace, longing, and petition, supplicating God and asking that he brings you to serve him in truth. So, say everything, you know. If you want something, I would say, inwardly say it and talk to the higher truth. Talk to the self, talk to consciousness, and say it. He says, such meditation should be in the language that you normally speak. It is difficult to express your thoughts in Hebrew, and the heart is therefore not drawn after the words. We do not normally speak Hebrew, and are not accustomed to expressing ourselves in this language. It is therefore much easier to express yourself in your native language. That's another one of these tensions between the sacred language. So in Jewish traditions, Hebrew. In the yogic tradition, Sanskrit. And in the Western tradition, Latin. All these are sacred languages. He's saying, use the vernacular. And the great Saint Yaneshwar Maharaj, he wrote about the Gita in Marathi, which is the local language, and he kept praising it, how great Marathi is, you know. And meaning is so important. So he says, speak in your normal language. You don't have to speak Hebrew or Latin or Sanskrit. In your everyday native language, express all your thoughts to God, speaking of everything that is in your heart. This can involve regret and repentance for the past, or requests and supplications. And you can ask for to truly come close to God in the future. So ask for everything you want, no matter how low and base the motive is, ask for that. And then ask to get closer to God, to be filled with higher consciousness, with energy, with Shakti. Every person can express his own thoughts, each according to his level. So you go into your inner space and then you just speak. You should be very careful with this practice, accustoming yourself to do it at a set time each day. The rest of the day can then be joyous. I suppose you're supposed to cry and weep. Why me? This is a very great practice. It's the best possible advice, including all things. It is good for everything that may be lacking in your relationship with God. Even if you're completely removed from God, you should still express your thoughts to Him and ask that He bring you back. So that reminds me of, there's a scene in Hamlet, you know, where Claudius, you know, the evil king who murdered Hamlet's father, you know who I'm talking about? And he's praying, and Hamlet wants to kill him, and he's praying and he says something like, my words go to heaven, but my thoughts remain below, and words without thoughts never to heaven go, something like that. And he's saying that, you know, it's empty words, and Hamlet won't kill him because he's at prayer, because he might get salvation if he kills him while he's at prayer. But the great Tukaram Maharaj used to talk to God. Anything was on his mind, he would speak to him. And so even if you feel far from God, just say, I feel far from God. What's that like? It's like the A statement in Shiva process, which is to be where you're at. First lesson spiritually is to discover where you're at and be where you're at. You can't get anywhere else until you first know where you're at and acknowledge it. Don't be ashamed of where you're at. Don't falsify where you're at. Be where you're at. Then movement is possible. He says, even if your words are blocked and you cannot open your mouth to God, you can still prepare yourself to do so. Even getting ready to speak to God is in itself very good. Even though you cannot speak to Him, you long and yearn to do so, and this itself is very good. You might say inside, oh, inner self, I want to experience joy and peace. Do you? Just say that inside. I want to experience joy and peace. I want to be strong. I want to be happy. I want to let go the suffering of my past, let go all the things that hurt me. And I want to be able to love myself and to love others. I want to feel full of energy and light. And all those words would be true because there's not one of us doesn't want those things. He says, you can cry out to God that you're so far from Him that you cannot even speak. You can ask Him to have mercy on you and open your mouth so that you should be able to express your thoughts to Him. That's if you feel blocked in that. You should know that very many great saints said that they only reach the highest levels through this practice of Hitbodhidup. If you have wisdom, you'll understand the importance of this practice and how it brings one higher and higher. Yet it is something that can be done equally by every individual, great and small alike. Everyone can observe this practice and reach the highest levels. Happy is he who does so. It's for everyone. It's not anybody's special province. Everyone can go inside themselves and find that authenticity. And when you hit that sweet spot, there's a great energy to it. And you know it. And when it's inauthentic, you feel it. You feel a jangling inside. Even if you cannot speak at all, he says, you should simply repeat a single word. And this too is very good. If you can say nothing else, remain firm and repeat this word over and over again, countless times. So it's even mantra, isn't it? So if you take a word like love, or strength, or joy, and repeat it over and over and over and over again, That's a mantra. Of course, we have a mantra that comes from a lineage of great beings. It has a slightly different purpose, but it's similar. God will eventually have mercy on you and open your heart so you'll be able to express all your thoughts. Speech has great power. And this is what Shaivism says. Speech, matrika, has great power. The language we use in communicating with others, and particularly the language inside of our own head, that has tremendous power. The words we tell ourselves elevate us or bring us down. The tearing thoughts, the negative thoughts we have about ourselves, they shrink our hearts, they make us miserable. And we learn to move, change the inner speech, that's changing the attitude. You must be worthy to be able to meditate for a given time each day. Not everyone can have such mental tranquility each day. The days pass and are gone, and you find you never had time to really think. Make sure, therefore, to set aside a specific time every day and review your life. Consider what you're doing and ponder whether it is worthwhile for you to devote your life to it. A person who does not meditate cannot have wisdom. He may occasionally be able to communicate, to concentrate, but not for any length of time. His power of concentration remains weak and cannot be maintained. Pardon me. Anyway, some practical things. It's best to meditate in the meadows outside the city. Go to a grassy field and the grass will awaken your heart. In the 60s, we used grass to awaken our hearts, too. Know that when you pray in the fields, all the grasses come into your prayers. They help you and give you strength to pray. It's written in Genesis 24. He says that the grasses help your prayer. And a few more. It's very good to have a special room set aside for scriptural study and prayer. Such a room is especially beneficial for secluded meditation and conversation with God. It's very good even to sit in such a special room. The atmosphere itself is beneficial, even if you sit there and do nothing. And similarly, in ashram, you come and sit in the atmosphere of the ashram. But even if you don't have it, you can still meditate and express your thoughts to God. He says, you can also meditate with God in bed under the covers. This was King David's custom. He said in Psalms 6 and 7, I meditate every night on my bed in tears, King David. You can also meditate, you can also converse with God while sitting before an open book. You can say, you have your book open, and you pretend to be reading it, and you're actually doing Hit Bodhidut. That's what I was doing in high school. Now I get it. There are many other ways in which you can accomplish this if you truly want to meditate and express your thoughts to God. Above all else, this is the root and foundation of holiness. Then he says, why this is superior to standardized prayers. See, these are free-form prayers. You know, we were taught probably when we grew up that there were formulae, and they were in the Bible. They were your Psalms or whatever, and that's what you did. Let us pray, and we repeat something, formula. He says, there are many prayers, supplications, and petitions that have already been composed. The destroyers and denouncers know of them and therefore lay in wait to ambush these prayers. So it's the devil. So the devil knows those standard prayers. The devil's reading that book and he's waiting there. He knows, wait, as soon as you open your mouth and read a psalm, he's on it. So if you do free form, if you do freestyle, he doesn't know, he catches them by surprise. By the time you've prayed, he catches up to you, you're gone. This is what he's saying. You can travel on a path that's well trod, known and publicized to all, but murderers and robbers also know of this road. and lay in wait there. When you travel on a byway, taking a route that is yet unknown, robbers are also ignorant of it. You be the sly man. You slightly paranoid. The same is true here. Your personal prayers before God are like a new root. They're prayers that have been composed in your heart and that are now being expressed for the first time. Therefore, no denouncers lie in wait for these prayers. But even more, they're not formulaic. They're actual, you can find the actual speech of your heart, and what's actually so for you. That's what's valuable about it. So he says you should also do the standard prayers. But so that's it. Let's try it, shall we? Hit Bodhidut. So we'll do a little guided meditation, and then we'll meditate for 10 minutes. So are you game to try? Okay, so the whole exercise will be about 10 minutes. And let's close our eyes and go inside. And you're going to have a dialogue. And you're going to speak to God or the Guru or the inner self or higher consciousness or other, the unconscious, however you conceive it. And you're going to be very aware of the different shifts in feeling that happen. You're going to use those shifts in feeling as a guideline to see if you're on the beam or not, that there should be an empowerment, a sense of empowerment, upliftment, when you're moving in the right direction. And you're going to be absolutely authentic, completely honest. You're going to say, "What so?" And so go inside, and be aware of whatever it is your condition is right now. And if there's something that you want, can be very material, something that you want, say that inside, "I want this, I want that, I want that." And ask that that be granted, and then let it go. You've made the statement to the highest, and then you give it over to the highest. And if there's something that you fear for yourself or your loved ones, then say that and ask that that be avoided, that you be protected. And then let that go. And then ask that you can get very close to your authentic self. Ask that you can be flooded with energy and light and love, that whatever blockages get in the way of that can be removed, that you can become the best version of yourself that you could be, you at your very, very best. And sometimes you get insight into blocks. You'll see them as you do this process. And whatever arises, deal with that in that moment. If a block arises, ask that it be removed. Or ask what you need to understand to have it removed. And keep the dialogue going until you get to a stillness or an energetic. And then continue to meditate in that place. So continue your dialogue freeform until you want to just be quiet. And we'll meditate for about 7 more minutes. Once again, with great respect and love, I welcome you all with all my heart.